content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family, and we wish to thank them for their support. And I'm going to start out with this joint January-February 2023 edition of Smithsonian with a section called The Past is Prologue, American Icon. And this article is by Hanif Abdurraqib. I wouldn't want him to hear me try to pronounce that. It's called Perfect Pitch, The Modest Marian Anderson Became a Pioneer in Music and in Civil Rights. In November 1955 at Carnegie Hall, Anderson performed Mozart, Schubert, spirituals, and more. And we turn the page. On Easter Sunday, 1939, Marian Anderson, wrapped in a fur coat against the April chill, stepped to the microphone atop the steps of the Lincoln Memorial and launched into America, My Country, Tis of Thee. First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt had assembled an integrated crowd of 75,000 people, an unprecedented honor for a black artist, who listened in solemn awe. Todd Duncan, a singer and voice teacher in the audience that day, described Anderson's performance as indelible. "I know my soul has it, and it will never leave," he told the Washington Post. One of the greatest contraltos in the history of American music, Anderson is best known for breaking color barriers. Indeed, no female American performer achieved more historic firsts. Perhaps the most widely celebrated came in 1943, when she became the first black artist to perform at the Daughters of the American Revolution's Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C., where she insisted successfully that the venue also welcome its first ever integrated audience. After the show, Anderson said with characteristic modesty, "I felt no different than I had in other halls. There was no sense of triumph." However self-effacing, she proved a mighty force for civil rights for four decades. As Secretary of the Interior Harold Eakes said while introducing Anderson at the Lincoln Memorial, "Genius, like justice, is blind. Genius draws no color lines." Anderson was born in Philadelphia in 1897 to a family of modest means. Her father sold ice and coal, and her mother made a living as a nanny. Marian Anderson first found her voice in the choir of the Union Baptist Church, built in the 1800s by the congregation, who would eventually fill it on Sundays. By the age of six, Anderson was earning a quarter every time she sang at a benefit concert. As her talents grew in her teen years, her rate rose to $5 a performance, a considerable sum for anyone, never mind a teenager. Despite a precocious beginning, Anderson struggled in early adulthood to find enough bookings in the United States to make a living. In 1930, she left for Europe and studied with the Finnish pianist Kosti Vananen, who would become her frequent accompanist. While in Finland, she found another collaborator, the composer Jean Sibelius. After she performed several of his own works for him in his home, Sibelius was rapt and went on to write several songs specifically for Anderson, including a version of his composition, Solitude, while helping her book larger venues on the continent. In 1933, she blew London away with a mix of classical music and spirituals at the storied Wigmore Hall, setting off a rapturous response among European crowds who watched her perform Marian Fever, a Swedish newspaper called it. She toured widely through Russia and Eastern Europe until 1934, when the tenacious American impresario Sol Hurok took over as Anderson's manager, luring her back to the States with a better contract than any she'd been offered before, plus promises to appear on major stages. Yep, segregation sharply limited her options. Constitution Hall, to name one venue, refused her a platform in 1939 on the basis of her race prior to her 1943 breakthrough. In 1937, after a performance at Princeton University's MacArthur Theater, Anderson was denied a room at the whites-only Nassau Inn. The physicist Albert Einstein invited her to stay at his home in Princeton, and the two formed a friendship that lasted until his death in 1955, with Einstein hosting Anderson at parties at his home. Nationally, she kept breaking barriers. In 1955, she became the first black singer to perform in a principal role at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City. Anderson's global stature reached new heights in 1957, when she became a goodwill ambassador for the State Department, giving concerts around the world. She had also trained, or rather entertained, troops during World War II and the Korean War. In 1963, Anderson sang as part of the March on Washington, returning to the Lincoln Memorial to offer a powerful rendition of He's Got the Whole World in His Hands. After her 1963 farewell concert at Carnegie Hall, the critic Harold Schoenberg of the New York Times wrote, "While she herself never militantly participated in the civil rights movement, she was revered by one who, by the forces of her personality, talent, and probity, was able to become a world figure despite her humble birth and minority status." Anderson's contralto was a remarkable, versatile instrument with the delicate mastery of opera and gospel alike. At the 1939 Lincoln Memorial Concert, she performed Ave Maria alongside Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Been and Gospel Train. She sang with a wisdom that lived beyond genre and was rooted instead in deep understanding of human suffering. She performed widely on three continents and left behind an inspired body of recordings. One of the earliest that still exists is a 1923 rendition of Deep River, one of many spirituals popularized by the Jubilee Singers in the late 1800s. The song's lyrics are sparse. They consist mostly of the single repeated line, "Lord, I want to cross over into campground," and the singer is almost required to exhaust the sound tucked within each vowel. There is a special beauty in the way Anderson pulls words apart, elongating them so that they stretch toward the infinite kingdom that is the subject of every spiritual. In Anderson's rendition, the 2.5 minutes of Deep River feels like a holy experience outside of time. In that 1923 performance, Anderson captured the deepest purpose of gospel music: seeking until new meaning is found. After Anderson's retirement in 1965, at age 68, she spent the next three decades out of the public eye on a farm in Danbury, Connecticut. Sometimes she would sing when the town lit up its Christmas tree. She died in 1993 at the age of 96, having lived much of her life to a melody all her own. I had to pause for a little drink of water. It's dry in our studio. And there's a sidebar to that article. On the record, a university archive focuses on the daily life of an elusive superstar by Ted Scheinman. And it's got a picture of a cutout from the newspaper of Marian Anderson's trials and triumphs. It's taken from her scrapbook of her 1957 tour through Asia, including sold-out concerts in China, India, Japan, Singapore, and Thailand. In 1960, Maria Cole, the wife of Nat King Cole, asked Marian Anderson about adding her signature to a statement by prominent black Democrats endorsing John F. Kennedy for president. Anderson replied that she considered it not possible to have her name identified with any particular party. That revealing exchange is just one glimpse into the artist's private life offered by the Marian Anderson Collection at the University of Pennsylvania, which holds the most comprehensive cache of Anderson materials in the world. Photographs, diaries, contracts, interviews, sheet music, and more, much of which has been digitized since 2017 and is available online. The archive is packed with clues to Anderson's life and artistry. What was she reading in 1941 as a 44-year-old? Her books list that year included W.E. Du Bois' Black Reconstruction and Anna L. Curtis's then new Stories of the Underground Railroad. She enjoyed meeting fans. While traveling by train in April 1951, the singer wrote, "A woman passenger who went by my door came back and said, 'You are a M.A., aren't you? I just want to say that I love you dearly.'" Rather, "You are M.A., so her initials. I added the A incorrectly. "You are M.A., aren't you? I just want to say that I love you dearly. You've given me so many wonderful hours of pleasure." Anderson also invited Eleanor Roosevelt to her debut at the Metropolitan Opera in 1955. "I owe you so very much, and the occasion would be incomplete without your presence." In her diaries, we see her close attention to her attire, pressed black and white taffeta dress, and left at 8:10, full hall. Anderson recalls being shocked the first time she heard her own voice coming out of a gramophone in a shop. "I couldn't get out of the store fast enough, and my heart pounded for a considerable time after I left. Why, it didn't sound like me. I haven't been able to express what it was." In a 1955 interview, Anderson said that never having children had been a very great sacrifice, particularly since she adored kids and had, in her words, enough ego to think she would have made an excellent mother. "Still, that sacrifice," she insisted, "was right, as far as I could see it." Continuing in the prologue section, Liberating Folk. A painter trained in Europe returned to embrace the American vernacular, by Amy Crawford. The African-American artist William H. Johnson, 1901 to 1970, had been painting expressionist landscapes in Europe for more than a decade when the threat of war forced him to return to the United States in 1938. With the move home came a dramatic shift in style and subject, as Johnson heeded Harlem Renaissance leader Alan Locke's call to do something on your own people. He committed to black life in America, says Virginia Mecklenburg, a curator at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, which holds more than 1,000 of Johnson's works. This phase of his career, characterized by a pseudo-folk sensibility that hints at African sculpture, culminated in the Fighters for Freedom series, which now on a national tour organized by the museum. The series places the Black American story within a broader global struggle, celebrating civil rights heroes like Frederick Douglass, as well as leaders working toward peace in the wake of World War II. It's the first time these paintings will appear together in more than 75 years, notes Mecklenburg, and it's something that seems, to me, ever more timely. And there's a painting in Europe to embrace the American vernacular, and it looks like two Black leaders that I can't distinguish who they are, and maybe Abe Lincoln. What do you call that kind of art? Anyway, we'll go on to this next article called still under the prologue section, History by Colin Woodard. The Frontier That Wasn't. Frederick Jackson Turner gave America its most enduring national mythology. Then he changed his mind. On the evening of July 12, 1893, in the hall of a massive new Beaux Arts building that would soon house the Art Institute of Chicago, a young professor named Frederick Jackson Turner rose to present what would become the most influential essay in the history, rather in the study of U.S. history. It was getting late. The lecture hall was stifling from a day of blazing sun, which had tormented the throngs visiting the nearby Chicago World's Columbian Exhibition. A carnival of never-before-seen wonders, like a fully illuminated electric city in George Ferris's 264-foot-tall rotating observation wheel. Thus came the name Ferris Wheel. Many of the 100 or so historians attending the conference, a meeting at the American Historical Association, were dazed and dusty from an afternoon spent watching Buffalo Bill's Wild West show at the stadium near the fairgrounds gates. They had already sat through three other speeches. Some may have been dozing off as the thin 31-year-old associate professor from the University of Wisconsin in nearby Madison began his remarks. Turner told them the force that had forged Americans into one people was the frontier of the Midwest and Far West. In his virgin world, settlers had finally been relieved of the European baggage of feudalism that their ancestors had brought across the Atlantic, freeing them to find their true selves, self-sufficient, pragmatic, egalitarian, and civic-minded. The frontier promoted the formation of a composite nationality for the American people, he told the audience. In the crucible of the frontier, the immigrants were Americanized, liberated, and fused into a mixed race, English in neither nationality nor characteristics. The audience was unmoved. In their dispatches the following morning, most of the newspaper reporters covering the conference didn't even mention Turner's talk, nor did the official account of the proceedings prepared by the librarian William F. Poole for The Dial, an influential literary journal. Turner's own father, writing to relatives a few days later, praised Turner's skills as the family's guide at the fair, but he said nothing at all about the speech that had brought them there. Yet in less than a decade, Turner would be the most influential living historian in the United States, and his frontier thesis would become the dominant lens through which Americans understood their character, origins, and destiny. Soon, Jackson's theme was prevalent in political speech, in the way high schools taught history, in patriotic paintings, in short, everywhere, perfectly timed to meet the needs of a country experiencing dramatic and destabilizing change. Turner's thesis was swiftly embraced by academic and political institutions, just as railroads, manufacturing machines, and telegraph systems were rapidly reshaping American life. By that time, Turner himself had realized that his theory was almost entirely wrong. American historians had long believed that Providence had chosen their people to spread Anglo-Saxon freedom across the continent. As an undergraduate at the University of Wisconsin, Turner was introduced to a different argument by his mentor, the classical scholar William Francis Allen. Extrapolating from Darwinism, Allen believed societies evolved like organisms, adapting themselves to the environment they encountered. Scientific laws, not divine will, he advised his mentee, guided the course of nations. After graduating, Turner pursued a doctorate at Johns Hopkins University, where he impressed the history program's leader, Herbert Baxter Adams, and formed a lifelong friendship with one of his teachers, an ambitious young professor named Woodrow Wilson. The connections were useful. When Allen died in 1889, Adams and Wilson aided Turner in his quest to take Allen's place as head of Wisconsin's history department. And on the strength of Turner's early work, Adams invited him to present a paper at the 1893 meeting of the AHA to be held in conjunction with the World's Congress, Auxiliary of the World's Columbian Exposition. The resulting essay, titled The Significance of the Frontier in American History, offered a vivid evocation of life in the American West, stripped of the garments of civilization. Settlers between the 1780s and the 1830s found themselves in the birch canoe wearing the hunting shirt and the moccasin. Soon they were planting Indian corn and plowing with a sharp stick, and even shouting war cries. Faced with Native American resistance, Turner largely overlooked what the ethnic cleansing campaign that created all the free land might say about the American character. The settlers looked to the federal government for protection from Native enemies and foreign empires, including during the War of 1812, thus fostering a loyalty to the nation rather than to their half-forgotten nations of origin. He warned that the disappearance of the force that had shaped them in 1890, the head of the Census Bureau concluded there was no longer a frontier line between areas that had been settled by European Americans and those that had not. Americans would no longer be able to flee west for an easy escape from responsibility, failure, or oppression. Each frontier did indeed furnish a new field of opportunity, a gate of escape from the bondage of the past, Turner concluded. Now, the frontier has gone, and with its going has closed the first period of American history. When he left the podium on that sweltering night, he could not have known how fervently the nation would embrace his thesis. Like so many young scholars, Turner worked hard to bring attention to his thesis. He incorporated into the graduate seminars he taught, lectured about it across the Midwest, and wrote the entry for Frontier in the widely read Johnson's Universal Encyclopedia. He arranged to have the thesis reprinted in the Journal of the Wisconsin Historical Society and in the AHA's 1893 annual report. Wilson championed it in his own writings, and the essay was read by hundreds of schoolteachers who found it reprinted in the popular pedagogical journal of the Herbert Society, a group devoted to the scientific study of teaching. Turner's big break came when the Atlantic Monthly's editors asked him to use his novel viewpoint to explain the sudden rise of populists in the rural Midwest and how they managed to seize control of the Democratic Party and make their candidate, William Jennings Bryan, its nominee for president. Turner's 1896 Atlantic Monthly essay, which tied the populist agitation to the social pressures allegedly caused by the closing of the frontier, soil depletion, debt, rising land prices, was promptly picked up by newspapers and popular journals across the country. Meanwhile, Turner's undergraduate students became tenured professors and disseminated his ideas to up-and-coming generations of academics. The thrust of the thesis appeared in political speeches, dime store Western novels, and even the new popular medium of film, where it fueled the work of a young director named John Ford, who would become the master of the Hollywood Western. In 1911, Columbia University's David Muzzey incorporated it into a textbook, initially titled History of the American People, that would be used by most of the nation's secondary schools for half a century. Americans embraced Turner's argument because it provided a fresh and credible explanation for the nation's exceptionalism, the notion that the U.S. follows a path soaring above those of other countries, one that relied not on earlier Calvinist notions of being the elect, but rather on the scientific and fashionable observations of Charles Darwin. In a rapidly diversifying country, the frontier thesis denied a special role to the eastern colonies' British heritage. We were instead a composite nation, birthed in the Mississippi watershed. Turner's emphasis on mobility, progress, and individualism echoed the values of the Gilded Age, when readers devoured Horatio Alger's rags-to-riches stories and lent them credibility for the generations to follow. But as a researcher, Turner himself turned away. Well, we're going to stop right there. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support from the Kepin family, and we wish to thank them for that support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138.